I'm going to begin by reading a news release that will be available and be passed out to you immediately. ASTP meeting. Meetings of the five United States-Soviet Union joint working groups involved in the Apollo-Soyuz test project will begin Thursday, March 15, at the Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center. Up to 47 Soviet scientists and engineers are expected to spend approximately 2 weeks at JSC to continue activities directed toward a cooperative manned mission in Earth orbit in July 1975. The visiting delegation will be headed by Professor Konstantin D. Bushuyev, Soviet technical director of the project, and is expected to include three cosmonauts, Vladimir A. Shatilov, Alexei S. Yeleseyev, and Nikolai N. Rukavishnikov. Shatilov and Yeleseyev are veterans of three Soyuz missions, and Rukavishnikov accompanied them on Soyuz 10. The U.S. group will be led by Dr. Glenn S. Lunny, U.S. Technical Director for ASTP. Operational aspects of the joint space mission will be emphasized, including in-flight experiments, sequence of crew transfer between spacecraft after docking, communications between control centers, and mission personnel training. Documents exchanged since the last meeting will be reviewed. Joint working groups cover the following five areas: mission model and operational plans, control and guidance, docking mechanism, communications and tracking, and life support systems and crew transfer. The last meeting of the full delegation was at JSC in July 1972. Several of the individual working groups have met here and in the Soviet Union since that time, and the technical directors have maintained regular communications. Astronauts Thomas P. Stafford, Vance D. Brand, and Donald K. Slayton were recently named as the prime U.S. flight crew for the mission. The Soviet Union has not yet announced flight crewmen. Our participants for the press conference tonight will be Dr. Robert L. Fleischer, General Electric Research and Development Center, Schenectady; Dr. Dmitry A. Papanastasiou, Division of Geological and Planetary Sciences, California Institute of Technology, Pasadena; Dr. Oliver A. Schaefer, Department of Earth and Space Sciences, State University of New York at Stony Brook; and should he arrive, Dr. Thomas Gold, Center for Radiophysics and Space Research, Cornell University. We're going to begin with Dr. Fleischer's report on the orange soil, and we'll have questions immediately following that so he can be free to leave. Dr. Fleischer.
Well, thank you. What we have been doing is making use of cosmic ray tracks in soil samples to learn something about their ages and deposition rates, ages being a different sort of age from what you'll hear from the other gentleman here about, but rather the recent history at the surface of the moon. We're making use of cosmic ray tracks, and let me, since I'm sure many of you aren't aware of what these are, let me say just a couple of words about that. The cosmic rays are made up of many different sorts of particles. Amongst these, there's a fairly abundant group of nuclei that are around the mass of iron and its near neighbors in the periodic chart. And these particles, when they enter lunar minerals, leave very narrow atomic trails of damage, disorder, which can be revealed by taking a chemical reagent and dissolving out the damaged stuff and then opening up the holes further. So you literally have tiny little holes that you can see and count. And they tell you how many cosmic rays of the iron group penetrated and entered these individual soil grains. And what we do then is to measure how many of these tracks are from in soil at a given depth, and use this from the, along with the known flux of these particles, to say how long the soil grains were sitting at whatever depth we're talking about. And we can use this to look at different levels in soil columns and trace out the rise and fall, it turns out, of these track densities, which tell us about the layering of soils. Many of these soil columns are made up of discrete layers that were put down one at a time, and looking at grains from each one of these allows you then to say, in an approximate way, how many years these individual layers spent exposed at the surface before they got covered up. And this is a very variable sort of thing. It may be less than a million years. It may be 50 million years. And out of that sort of thing, we get a measure of the deposition rate at different places, which typically turns out to be about a third of a centimeter every million years. One of the particular samples that we've been interested in just lately, during the last week, since it was last Wednesday afternoon that we received some of this orange soil, is its surface age on the moon. The last time that soil was stirred around a little bit by some sort of a meteorite impact, we estimate that as being about 6 million years ago. And from the most abundant track densities that we find in there, we get some idea of the total time that that soil spent at the depth that it was found, which is in the range of 20 to perhaps 30 million years. So although from other lines of evidence, it's known that this is very old soil in when it was formed, it was only exposed close to the surface very recently.
Would you like to ask questions?
You say 20 to 30 million years it's been close to the surface?
Yes, by that
the release here says 8 to 10. Now, what's the...
Yes, the real thing that there are two numbers that we've got there. One of these is when it was last disturbed. We are saying that it was brought to that position from the surface at one time, and it was stirred at least once since then, and the most recent time was about 6 million years ago. Now, that is indeed a little different from what was written there, and that's as a result of some further thought and some greater data that we've accumulated since that time.
Do I understand correctly that it is 6 billion years old, was stirred once 20 to 30 million years ago,
no,
and then stirred again 6 million years ago?
No, I haven't mentioned the word billion there. That's in the regime of some of these other gentlemen. The things that we can say are, first, that this was brought to roughly 5 centimeters from the surface about 20 to 30 million years ago, and secondly, that it was last disturbed by an impact about 6 million years ago.
Are there other questions?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Could I get you to repeat that concisely, what you just said? Wouldn't that sound possible?
Right. our statement is...
I understand you to say that the other scientists have a differing view. How do you account for what apparently is going to be a vastly different view between what you've said and what they're saying?
Yeah, I don't think there's any difference that I know of in view here. It's a different sort of measurement tells a different thing. Other people have measured the actual solidification time of the material that makes up this soil, and that could well have occurred, and presumably did, a long, long time ago. And then the material was presumably covered up so that it was shielded by overlying lunar material until recently by lunar standards.
I seem to recall there was a very thin layer of dark material on top of the orange soil. Did you also get a look at that to see how long that...
No, we have not received any of that sample, so in principle we ought to be able, if we get some of that, to find out how long ago that was set down, but right now we have no idea. We do have another sample from nearby, and that turns out to have been last disturbed about the same time that the orange soil was, and so that fits together in a reasonable way, I think.
Can you say how to what extent it was disturbed 6 million years ago, and would that account for its fresh appearance?
I tend to doubt that. Impacts are thought to be the primary cause of rearranging things, and when you start jostling nice little bits of glass together, you tend to dent them, break them up, and scratch them. So the fewer such things that occur, the fresher your material will look. And so basically what we infer from our track measurements is that the soil grains were rearranged in there, but they were not badly broken up in that recent impact.
Would you be please wait for the microphone?
Can you estimate how large an impact would have done that?
No, I'm afraid we really don't have any good information on that. Well, from other evidence, from the fact you scoop under this orange soil and you find darker soil, I think it's likely that it was not so large as to disarrange that underlying material. So that would suggest a fairly shallow event.
What does your data tell you about the origin of the orange soil?
I'm afraid we don't have anything that really tells us very much about that. I think the other gentlemen here are much closer to the beginnings of that soil and what their information tells us.
You say you only received the sample last Wednesday. Is that enough of a time to get a valid conclusion?
Yeah, I think so. We've got measurements now on 131 different soil grains, and we've been able to assess how permanent the tracks are in these by doing heating experiments, which are very critical to it. And we've also had a chance to do some particle identification work in these that indicate that, yes, most of these particles are the iron group cosmic rays, and they're not primarily fission tracks, which are other things that you might imagine would be present there.
I understand you didn't get any tracks at all prior to 20 to 30 million years ago?
Yeah, I think that's basically what we're saying. Actually, we could not rule out other more complicated sorts of pictures here. It could be that this thing was exposed for some brief period of time in the much more distant past, for a time of, let's say, 15 million years, and then covered up by a great thickness again, and then uncovered 6 million years ago, so as to add up the total exposure time that it's had near the surface. Now, that's just a much less likely sort of situation, but the direct evidence couldn't rule out something more complicated like that.
What is the maximum depth that a cosmic ray can penetrate and leave a track in the lunar soil?
Well, they can go in a long ways, but most of them are stopped within the top few millimeters, and you go down by factors of, by another factor of 10 in going a few centimeters down, and a couple more factors of 10 in going down to 15 centimeters into the moon. And at every depth, there is some probability, but it drops off so rapidly that to all purposes, you're measuring the near surface exposure when you count these things.
The number of tracks then indicates that it's shallower then, so that you can, is that how you arrive at the depth? In other words, the more copious the tracks are near the surface?
In arriving at the depth, we're accepting the statement of the crew when they came back that they scooped down to a particular depth, and that's where these came from. Unless we have a series of samples from different depths, we would not be able to derive what that depth was. So to the extent that depth is inaccurate, then we would have to shift these numbers. And that's why I said 20 to 30 million years for the near surface exposure. That's some evaluation of how well we think that depth is known.
Is
then you don't know from what depth it came to the point that it arrived at the 20 to 30 million year ago point, do you?
You don't
know its beginning depth.
That's right, yes. We do not know its beginning depth. We only know a limit on it, that it must have been greater than 15 centimeters down.
But presumably when this stuff was first formed, it was on the surface then, wasn't it? Is it necessary to assume that? And if it were, would you be able to see cosmic ray tracks from that time back 3.7 billion years ago?
Yes, certainly there's clear evidence that these particle tracks could be retained over that long a time. Presumably, either they were thrown down on the surface at the beginning of things and then covered up rather quickly, or it's possible that they were thrown out and covered up by the same event that threw them out, that there was just more stuff following them that covered them up.
Did you see any tracks that looked to be much older than the 20 to 30 million years?
We unfortunately don't, at the present time, have a way of telling old tracks from new tracks.
How can you be sure? I don't understand how you can't tell old tracks from new tracks if you can tell tracks that are 30 million years old.
No, we're using the count of how many are there to say how long it was exposed close to the surface. And literally, that's what we can derive. Now, this time could have been spaced out and distributed differently from the picture that I've given, which is what I think is the most plausible sequence.
Some of those tracks could be tracks left over from 3.7.
Absolutely, yes, they could be.
How do you tell tracks from the first exposure from those of the second exposure?
We don't know any way of doing that, unfortunately.
How do you get the second event?
We're looking at the track frequency distribution in different grains. When you move things around, some grains are pulled up from deeper down, and others are pulled down, so to speak, from having been closer to the surface.
How much movement are you talking about when it was last disturbed?
Well, we're talking about vertical distances comparable with this 5 centimeters.
Would move at 5 centimeters?
Yeah, some grains moved up 5, some moved down 5.
Well, Robert, what does it look like to you?
Look like in what regard?
How it got there, what caused it, and what would be this process, the shuffling process?
Well, the simplest picture that I can see of this is that the material was born however long ago these gentlemen say, 3-point-something billion years ago. The fact that you've got little glass beads certainly suggests that something violent threw out stuff, which then solidified into these little beads. The simplest picture would have these being covered up very promptly, either by more of the same event material from the same event descending on top of this stuff, or by another impact somewhere else, rather soon covering it up, and soon could be 500,000 years from our point of view. And then it stayed covered by more than 15 centimeters of stuff throughout most of the rest of the history of the moon up to about, let's say, 25 million years ago when it was exposed at the surface. And then perhaps 6 million years ago, you've got a rearrangement of this material. There might have been another rearrangement before that. And then since we find that there is this separate layer of soil on top of it, there must have been some other nearby event that threw some more material on top.
Do you base your analysis solely on iron nuclei, or do you also work with other nuclei like protons and helium, nitrogen, and what have you?
Happily, the minerals that we work with do not see these lighter things. And the reason I say happily is that we would be so crowded with tracks that it would be very hard to count them properly. We are using essentially iron and its near neighbors in the periodic chart as our timekeeping agent here.
Does it start at about iron then, or where does it start?
It starts just below iron, and it happens. Iron is relatively rather abundant, and then when you get to elements that are much heavier than iron, they are suddenly much less abundant. You see occasional heavier particles, and you can identify that they're there and their rough abundance by the fact that you can get much longer tracks from the heavier elements.
Two questions. Have you done this track counting on other samples? And if so, have you ever found any that had been disturbed in a more recent era?
Oh, absolutely. There was a green soil that was found in Apollo 15. And I think that contains the most recent, recently and briefly exposed material that we know about. We were talking 500,000 years for the exposure of that near at the surface.
Maybe I'm a little dense,
but if you say you can detect cosmic ray tracks that are 3.7 billion years old, what is to prevent you from theorizing that, and the way you arrive at these figures is on the basis of the track density. How come it couldn't be that the thing was formed 3.7 billion years ago, lay on the surface for 30 million years then, and then all of it then got covered, and just now has popped up?
Well, you could that could be done. I think that's not impossible.
We don't really know when that 30 million year period was, whether it's all 30 million years now in recent times, or 15 million years after it's formed and then 15 million years now.
Yeah, I think that technically that is correct. I think it is a much less likely sequence. We know things were happening at a much greater rate on the moon a long time ago. That is, the frequency of impacts was much greater. So this material would have been better off, so to speak, if it had been covered up at that time. And in general, things that you pick up now that have been exposed to cosmic rays have been exposed recently, during recent time, to cosmic rays.
I'll take one last question.
You must be assuming a steady rate of cosmic rays over a long period.
Yes, that is certainly one of the assumptions that goes into this, and I think we have pretty good information that back over quite a few millions of years that is a good description. When you start getting back more than 100 million years, the evidence becomes not nearly so precise nor reliable. But that is one of the assumptions, and I think no clear violations of that have ever, to my knowledge, been uncovered.
Thank you, Dr. Fleischer.
Okay. Please excuse me, but I did have some previous engagement that I got waylaid from that I'd better get back.
Thank you. Perhaps we can ask Dr. Schaefer to reflect on the actual age of the orange soil, the formation of it. Dr. Schaefer?
For the orange soil?
Yes, would you?
I think the reason you'd like to say that is because you find orange soil fragments in all orange spherical fragments in all soils from all missions, but you don't find a large concentration in other missions. and it has the same composition as the subfloor basalts chemically, and that's what you'd expect from an impact, that is, you melt the rock that you hit, whereas from a volcanic event, you might expect that the chemistry would change. You'd expect some of the more volatile elements would be removed. So the evidence seems preponderant in that favor, but I wouldn't say it's overwhelming, that it was an impact event that took place 3.7 billion years ago, so it was probably some meteoroid striking in that vicinity at that time.
It was my impression from other investigators who were also looking at that soil that the impact origin had been ruled out because it was not glued together with other materials, that it was sort of a beast unto itself, so to speak. In other words, that it was separate. And if it had been impact originated, that it probably would be more brecciated with other materials.
Well, I don't think that's true. For example, you find a similar thing on the Earth. You find tektites, which are bigger than these spherules, but they are glassy objects that occur in sort of a strewn field. You find, I understand, in ocean cores, very tiny sort of things. So that those are definitely from impacts on the Earth. They couldn't be volcanic events. And I think in an impact, is you're liable to have some splash glasses that are thrown out in fine amounts, so they would form spherical objects when they cool. That'd be the natural shape for them.
Dr. Schaefer, what is the composition of the orange soil, and do you believe it's uncommon on the moon, or that there's a great deal of it?
Well, I can't tell you exactly, but it's the same as the subfloor basalts in that area. And so it's a common chemical composition. These subfloor basalts may be somewhat different than the others. I mean, that may be true.
I thought it was high in zinc or something. I remember it was high in something. It was unusual.
I think these subfloor basalts are too. Okay.
No, it's much more, I believe, than the. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Schaefer, how do you think this soil got to the surface so recently, or so close to the surface so recently, if Dr. Fleischer's?
Well, I think if you had just a small, suppose it was within a few meters of the surface, then you need a relatively small impact to bring it to the surface. And I mean, if it was even less than a few meters, then you'd even less of an impact. So it was probably close to the surface recently, and then some impact, maybe the impact that formed Shorty Crater, for example, exposed the orange soil.
Well, what makes it orange?
It's the titanium and the iron in the glass.
Have you dated other Apollo 17 samples, basalts, for instance?
We've dated four of the basalt fragments.
What age?
They give ages from 3.72 to 3.79. The errors are such that they could all be the same age.
Would you comment on some of the other papers your group has presented here? We understand that one of your colleagues presented some dates yesterday on the Apollo 16 rocks at around 4.2. And would you tell us whether that was a recrystallization or initial crystallization date?
On that particular sample, or a set of samples, is a thing that the petrologists call a light matrix breccia. And this is a not uncommon rock type in the northern excursions near North Ray Crater. And so you're led to sort of conjecture that possibly North Ray Crater at its impact, the bottom material could have been this kind of a rock. Now, to be a little more clear as to what a light matrix breccia is, in this particular one that's described here, is the rock was originally, when it was first crystallized, a thing that's called an anorthosite. That's a common mineral in the highland areas. It's rich in calcium and it's relatively poor in potassium. It's a silicate mineral. Then, at some time after its formation, and it might have been very large crystals at this point. At some time after its formation, there was some event, probably an impact, that melted part of that rock. Part of those plagioclase crystals melted, but they didn't all melt completely. And then these plagioclase crystals, the melted ones, cooled slow enough so that the rock is crystalline today. And so it's called a breccia because it has part of the original rock in it, and it has part of the new matrix. The ground mass is very fine-grained, and the old rock, which cooled much slower, is very coarse-grained. So you have these two rocks, and so the age then would be sort of a composite age because it's probably original crystals might not have been reset. So it could be that the age that you get is older than the event that formed the rock somewhat. The older rock is certainly older, but it could have been a million years older, or it could have been 100 million years older. You can't really answer that question with the information we have available at the present time. Yeah.
Well, 4.2 billion, does that make it the oldest?
That would make it the oldest rock where you have a piece in your hand that was solidified at that time.
Yes, but now when you talk of the 4.2 billion, are you saying that is the age of that recrystallization of the formation of the breccia, or is that the age of some fragment in there that never got recrystallized, therefore that the rock itself got brought together or remelted sometime later?
It's probably an average age between the matrix, and we have a range. We have four or five of these fragments, and there's a range in matrix to original crystal ratio that varies from maybe 3:1 one way to 3:1 the other way. And they all give ages that lie between 4.20, I think one's as low as 4.15, and 4.25. So there can't be too much of a difference, really, between the two ages. But that's true. I mean, you could have if the older rock were very old, if the crystals included were very old, then the young age might have been a good bit younger than the 4.25.
Yeah, now, this brings to mind the problem with analyzing the Rock 13,
yes,
where at first it was widely said to be 4.5 billion years old, but then it was discovered that was one of those little fragments that never got remelted, yet the rock itself conglomerated at about 4 billion years. Could this be what is happening here?
No, this is a different kind of a situation. It couldn't be. A major part of this rock has to be very old.
Okay, I think what we're struggling with is, did you date a single crystal that did not recrystallize when the breccia was formed?
Well, we dated the average age of the original crystallization and the brecciation. We have an average of those two.
Do you have the extreme ages? In other words, the age of the original
crystallization? Well, I'm telling you that. See, we have it's a ratio. We have fragments that run 3-1 one way and 3-1 the other. That's a range of 10 in compositional variation. And we find that it varies from something like 4.1 to 4.25. So the extreme age has to be a few hundred million years, something like that. It can't be much more than that. And what that would say then, that the original, supposedly where the maximum case, 200 or 300 million years, and you could split it in half and say that the original rock was formed 200 million years before that, or half of the difference in the cataclysmic event that formed this rock was 100 million years later. But this is sort of the average of the two. They almost certainly have to be close in time because of this wide compositional variation and rather tight age determinations.
Back to the orange soil just a moment, sir. When the soil was first found and first brought back, there was a great deal of excitement about it. From what you have learned and what you know now, did that original excitement justify itself?
Gee, that's hard. I don't know how you justify excitement, you know.
Did it produce the information or new findings that it was at hoped
to
at the
time? I think the orange soil has been the age of the orange soil and the age of the breccias in this in the dark mantling material have been very useful in drawing such conclusions that it becomes extremely likely that large-scale lunar volcanism stopped something like 3 billion years ago, and I think that's one kind of thing. I think it would have been a more of a problem for people who worry about the cooling of the moon and things like that if there would have been a recent volcanism on the moon. And that's, if you call that excitement, that's true. That would have been an excitement.
Dramatically different information than what you've been receiving all along in the other rock samples.
Well, I think it does.
Yeah, let me put it another way, actually, which is possibly just a different philosophical discussion, which is part of excitement. The mere fact that an astronaut, or actually a man who's used to what is happening on the Earth, went to the moon, and the minute he saw something, said, aha, that's what it is, and he thought he knew what it was all about, immediately indicates that, in fact, when you're in a different environment, you don't know what to expect. And the mere fact that you found out that what you thought was immediately obvious is not true anymore is already quite exciting and a progress in itself.
Dr. Papanastasiou, would you like to reflect on the theory you presented and how this is affected by Dr. Schaefer's information?
Now, the variety of rocks on the lunar surface and their variety of ages that one obtains, and I think actually the immediately preceding discussion and maybe a little bit the earlier discussion with Dr. Fleischer first indicates some confusion about what an age means, and also indicates that in some cases it's rather complex and it may even be too complex to assign an age or a specific age to a particular sample in any of the ways that we normally think of an age, like different ages. An age that one can normally think of is when the rock crystallized, which means, you know, a molten piece of rock separating different minerals, and so you date that event. And a kind of different age would be when you had a hot or a warm rock which did not retain argon in this case, and cooled far enough down so it started retaining argon. In one case, you would obtain a crystallization age. In another case, you would obtain the so-called gas retention age, which would be the age since this rock started not losing argon, which is a gas produced from potassium. Those would be the simplest things that one can think of as ages. Some of these samples are breccias, which means they're mixed up rocks. They're composed of older rocks, in quotes, enclosed in other rocks, and so that if you do in fact have to consider an average between particles that pre-existed this brecciation or mixing event and the effects that happen after that, it becomes rather fishy how one interprets this age, and therefore the easy way of thinking about ages may not be totally valid. Now, the information we have presented involves two different kinds of ages or processes. We have inferential evidence that tells us that something occurred on the moon close to 4.5 billion years ago. What we envision this process to be is the formation of a lunar crust. What in fact we observe is that both in the soils and in certain rocks, we find considerably higher abundances of certain specific elements, in particular potassium, rubidium, uranium. And these are the same types of elements which on the Earth are increased in their concentration in the crustal rocks. So by analogy, we are saying that very early in the history of the moon, essentially within a couple hundred million years after the moon accreted, it was melted by some process which is really not established, but it was melted in such a fashion that a significant part of these elements were moved up and migrated to the surface and are therefore associated with a crust on the moon. So this, however, age of approximately 4.4 to 4.6 is a model age obtained with some calculations and reasonable assumptions, and is not the same as having a rock that crystallized at 4.5 billion years ago and has since not been reheated, at which time, you know, that's a nice, simple rock that one can understand. But so we don't have rocks that are as old as 4.5 billion years old. We start having rocks that are this complex recrystallized and brecciated rocks. They all give ages in the interval 3.9 to 4 billion years ago. And we have now collected all these rocks from a significant number of sites on the moon, including Apollo 14, Rock 13 from Apollo 12, which was actually a special rock at that site, Apollo 16, Luna 20, and also Apollo 17, where we have in fact measured a rock collected from, that's supposed to have fallen down in the valley from the highlands. So all this great number of samples in the rather narrow range, but in fact there is a range in those ages of 3.9 to 4 billion years ago, indicates a rather major event at that instant, and we have called it a cataclysm because that sounds like a good word. Now, so what we can tell is that something big occurred at 4 billion years, and it followed something that appears to be a major thing that occurred between 4.4 and 4.6. We don't have, at least and I'll discuss the ages of 4.2 in a little while, but we consider that we don't have any evidence of what went on between 4 and 4.4, which is really very secure evidence. Anything essentially could have gone on during that time. You could have still had a very high bombarding or impacting rate of meteorites and comets and other things on the moon during the interval 4.0 to 4.4. It's just that, at least the way we look at the data, we don't have any such solid evidence. Whereas in principle, it's quite possible that we will find a rock that is 4.2 and even 4.4 billion years old. There's really nothing that says that. If we look harder in the existing samples, and nobody has really barely scratched the number of samples that we have, we won't find some such rocks. Now then, after this cataclysm, we have a rather extensive flooding of all the Mare region on the moon, which lasted from 3.8, or which means really immediately following this cataclysm, up to 3 billion years ago, and we don't find any evidence for significant activity post 3 billion years ago. Now, since presumably this meeting was called because of this confusion about the 4.2 billion year old ages, I just want to say that the particular method, which is the potassium-argon method used in its stepwise heating form of irradiated samples, has in the past yielded rather complex patterns which have defied the normal simple interpretation that was thought to be adequate at the time of Apollo 11 and before we actually gained some experience with lunar rocks. I think we have found enough complex rocks, and these are complex rocks where these old ages occur, that the evidence must be viewed as not very secure yet, and maybe we'll just discuss a little bit longer later, but so we just don't view the experimental evidence as definitive at this stage for to interpret these light matrix breccias or some or whatever they are in fact good honest crystallization ages that we can identify with a specific event at that time being 4.2. Okay, that's all.
Is there any reason why this rock couldn't be dated by other methods, like rubidium strontium or whatever the other dating methods are?
Well, the specific rocks where these data were obtained on were, of course, rather small fragments, by small meaning the order of 30 or 40 milligrams, I think, which means they don't exist anymore. Now, similar data on similar fragments can in fact be obtained by the rubidium strontium method in ideal cases, and in specific cases it just in my point of view, we have measured some breccias, really bigger or samples of bigger rocks which in general terms have the same characteristics as this breccias, and and we don't find this evidence now. I mean, one can always worry about how many rocks we have to analyze before we actually find the one lucky rock that is 4.2, and maybe it has in fact been found. I just think that at this stage, the conclusions are not that strong about the existence of such rocks.
Could I comment on that?
Yes.
I'd like to comment on some of the points that Dr. Papanastasiou made. Going back, if you compare a crystallization age to a gas retention age, in all cases where that comparison was made, for lunar rocks, where one used a crystallization age determined by a rubidium strontium isochron, the gas retention age came out to be the same within the errors of both methods. And the potassium-argon method, when it gives a plateau, the plateau age has always agreed with the crystallization age as measured by rubidium strontium. There are a number of cases where the potassium-argon method doesn't give a plateau. And we have maybe twice as many samples of these old light matrix breccias than we report on. We have cases where they don't give a plateau. That means there's excess loss of argon from the sample during heating. And that shows up in the method. That's what makes the method valid, where a normal potassium-argon dating is not valid. It usually gives a young age. We have also in our sequence, our suite, four or five fragments of an orthosite, which are not breccias. They're pure orthosite crystals. And they give ages around 4.1 billion years with an error of something like 0.05. They're not quite as old as the light matrix breccias. So it seems to me that the light matrix breccias are definite evidence as to what was happening between 4.0 and 4.4 billion years. And indeed, they may even cover the whole gap in between. If we take apart a light matrix breccia, and it's possible to do potassium argon then on the matrix separate from the crystalline inclusions, it may be possible to even fill in this gap even more by studying these rocks. And I think the study of these light matrix breccias are a good candidate for the investigation as to what happened on the moon during this very early part of its history.
I'm not quite sure. The fragments, the rock that you obtained, the 4.2 billion year age, did you examine fragments from a larger rock, or were they just fragments?
What we've been working with, a thing that's called in the jargon, coarse finds. And what that means is when you get the soil back, you sieve it, and you get various sieve fractions, and anything coarser than a millimeter is called coarse fines. And we work with a sieved fraction that's between 2 and 4 millimeters, goes through those sieve sizes. And so we've gone through something like 500 rock fragments. These were once part of a larger rock that was broken out by processes taking place on the surface of the moon. So in this way, you get a very good suite of rock types to examine. And in each case, we split the sample in half and make a thin section of the rock so we can study the petrology, and the other half we use for the age dating. So in each case, we have a small fragment of each one of these rocks left. It's in the form of a thin section. It's not very in a good form for any present known methods of dating.
We really are quite helpless to understand what is the difference of opinion. There's obviously some small difference of opinion between one person has expressed a lack of confidence in doing potassium argon on some kinds of brushes, and the other person expresses confidence in doing this. What is the substantive difference? Obviously, we're popularizers and rather helpless. We really would like to know whether we are getting into something interesting or whether we still have this big blank.
Well, I think that the rock, as far as the northside would go, there'd be no difference of opinion at all. But when you come to this breccia, you can have part of it younger and part older. And we only feel that that age is close because of the close-knit where our ages cluster. Now, you can always say you don't believe something, but in every case where there's been a comparison, it's always turned out to be the same. So I don't know of any case where you have a rubidium strontium age that differs from a potassium argon age determined this way. So that's what the what that difference is based on. I think what Dimitri's saying, well, here's a rock that we haven't really compared yet. I'm afraid that it's not going to be possible to make a comparison if all light matrix breccias are the ones we find, because they're extremely low in potassium, which means they'll be very low in rubidium, they're very high in calcium, so they'll be, there won't be enough spread to really get a good isochron.
I'll say something, I guess. The statement that when the potassium argon method and the rubidium strontium method have been compared, they have or when they can be compared, have given identical result, is not, to my way of thinking, a complete statement, because of the following. During Apollo 11, the one obtained several results on total rocks, which means you take the whole rock as it is, all minerals together, and you use it for the potassium argon method, and you obtained what is was defined at the time as a good plateau, which means, you know, good flat line, and that was interpreted as an age. What occurred after that is that some people were not satisfied that, in fact, a line, which after all had a little bit of curvature, and everything that has a little bit of curvature can always be considered flat if you don't look very closely, was in fact flat. And so people at Caltech separated out different minerals from the rock. In particular, they separated a plagioclase mineral, and they found out that in ideal cases, which really means Mara basalts, that single isolated mineral gave even better agreement with rubidium strontium. And what was more important was that the much better defined plateau for the plagioclase, potassium argon plateau, in fact, in several cases, disagreed with the whole rock plateau, although both lines looked reasonably flat, and anybody would have called them flat, but they were in fact offset. So that was one problem that we learned something about. When Apollo 14 came around, we did some rather detailed work on potassium argon with exactly this method, and found some rather peculiar patterns where, in fact, they didn't look like plateaus. They looked like S-shaped curves. But after all those S-shaped curves were obtained in infinite detail, the observation was made that if you average the two parts of the S, it just so happened that you agreed with the rubidium strontium age. That was an after-the-fact decision, and it was rather amazing that, in fact, it turned out that way and still not really understood very well. But since that agreement occurred, people said, well, there's basically agreement, and we don't understand something, but there's no point in forgetting everything about potassium argon. So work has really been going on. There have been some small or large surprises that have been found out about Apollo 16 rocks, which are also complicated rocks, where we find that the plagioclase from a rock, which is now not the regular Mara basalt, but it's what we call an igneous rock, which is really a breccia that has been heated to an extensive degree so that it has in fact equilibrated with its different parts. we find that the plagioclase from this one rock is the one that is crazy, and that the whole rock agrees with the rubidium-strontium method. And therefore, this business of subjectively shifting back and forth between one type of agreement and another, and precise agreement and approximate agreement with the rubidium-strontium method, is rather fishy, and that's what makes me a little bit more careful that I do not wish, in a new case without good controls, to believe these results. Now, in the rubidium-strontium method, we have also found several disturbed systems, which means that even in that method, we have identified that the plagioclase class, or big crystals in a matrix, in a breccia, have not, in fact, been heated enough to equilibrate or to be remelted with the bulk of this breccia, or the bulk material.
Dr. Papasanti, perhaps I can ask you if you would focus particularly on what effect this 4.2 billion year date, if it were to be accurate, would have on the cataclysmic theory that was presented with a 3.95 billion year.
Okay, the cataclysmic theory is sort of an observational fact that we observe an awful lot of ages at 4 billion years. Like I think I start early by saying is there is a priori, or in principle, no reason to believe that there aren't rocks older than 4 billion years that have been preserved on the moon. It's quite possible that tomorrow we'll go back in the lab and find one of the samples that Dr. Schaefer is talking about, and then if we satisfy ourselves, we'll certainly give him credit for being the first one to have found them. All I'm saying is that at this stage we don't believe that. Otherwise, it would be important to find out if in fact there exists things 4.2 billion years old or a little bit older, because we would have our hands on something specifically that was affected by such processes. The cataclysm in itself would not be affected, and neither would be the early differentiation of the moon be affected. We would just increase our knowledge about this interval of 4 to 4.4, where we now think we have a blank.
Dr. Rowe, would you like to briefly comment on what's been said?
Yes, I think that people are getting very fidgety here, and I don't want to hold you up any longer. I just want to make one very general comment. Of course, you can always have a naughty person like myself piping up and saying you could have the moon made just yesterday out of exactly the materials you now find there. Well, and there's nothing against that. We could all have been created by God yesterday with our brains intact as we now find them and our memories. You know, there's obviously no argument against that. But if you say, well, we have to assemble the moon from bits and pieces, we don't know where they came from and how they were initially made, the bits and pieces, but you have to assemble them onto the moon without the assistance of God himself, then you say, well, I cannot lower them onto the surface extremely slowly because they have to fall in at least at the speed of escape from the moon, 2.5 kilometers a second. So therefore, you come to the conclusion, no, you could not have assembled the moon at will from a material which is just as you now find it, if you are constrained by the fact that that material must have fallen in. And where does this constraint come is the thing that has concerned me very much, because I'm not prepared to just go along with the herd saying, oh, well, we all think that that's how old it is and that the material was primeval stuff. I have no idea what the material was that made. I've studied the origin of the solar system problems, and I'm sure that it's a very complicated business what the material was that formed the moon in the first place. The only evidence we have for an age of an existing body is the age of the rock that has such a size that it could not have survived falling onto the moon without breaking into smaller pieces. That's the only very definitive thing that we have. That's to say, it has to be a substantial chunk. Small pieces like that can survive if they fall onto a soft powder. The small grains of the powder itself Indeed, the orange soil, for all that I know, could have fallen in from outside of the composition which it now has. In fact, you should think of the orange soil, I think, as one possibility that there is a layer of a few centimeters thick over the whole moon. Only you happen to have come across it in this little patch because, of course, it's been knocked about here and there, and you were just lucky that this was a patch where it had been protected and was only subsequently found. All that is still a possibility. As I say, there's no general argument against that. It's only the specific argument to say, I do not believe that materials of the particular composition and petrography and so on that we now find on the surface could have been generated on some other body and then fallen on the moon. But I must admit that I could believe it, except for rocks that are of substantial size, that they must have been formed on the moon because I could not have lowered them there without breaking them.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much.